Jake remembered this voice saying before its owner had discovered the dubious attractions of amplification. Tell me all you know about dipolar computers and transitive circuits. Tell me and I'll give you a drink. It wasn't Jonas, and it wasn't the wizard of anything. It was David Quick's grandson. It was the TikTok man. 7. Jake stared at him, horrified. The coiled, dangerous creature who had lived beneath Ludd with his mates, Gasher and Hoots and Brandon and Tilly, was gone. This might have been that monster's ruined father or grandfather. His left eye, the one Oi had punctured with his claws, bulged white and misshapen, partly in its socket and partly on his unshaven cheek. The right side of his head looked half-scalped, the skull showing through in a long triangular strip. Jake had a distant, panic-darkened memory of a flap of skin falling over the side of TikTok's face. But he had been on the edge of hysteria by that point, and was again now. Oi had also recognized the man who had tried to kill him, and was barking hysterically, head down, teeth bared, back bowed. TikTok stared at him with wide, stunned eyes. "Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain," said a voice from behind them, and then tittered. "My friend Andrew is having another in a long series of bad days. Poor boy. I suppose I was wrong to bring him out of Ludd, but he just looked so lost." The owner of the voice tittered again. Jake swung around and saw that there was now a man sitting in the middle of the great throne, with his legs casually crossed in front of him. He was wearing jeans, a dark jacket that belted at the waist, and old, run-down cowboy boots. On his jacket was a button that showed a pig's head with a bullet hole between the eyes. In his lap, this newcomer held a drawstring bag. He rose, standing in the seat of the throne like a child in daddy's chair, and the smile dropped away from his face like loose skin. Now his eyes blazed, and his lips parted over vast, hungry teeth. "Get them, Andrew! Get them! Kill them! Every sister fucking one of them! My life for you!" the man in the alcove screamed, and for the first time Jake saw the machine gun propped in the corner. TikTok sprang for it and snatched it up. "My life for you!" He turned, and Oi was on him once again, leaping forward and upward, sinking his teeth deep into TikTok's left thigh, just below the crotch. Eddie and Susanna drew in unison, each raising one of Roland's big guns. They fired in concert, not even the smallest overlap in the sound of their shots. One of them tore off the top of TikTok's miserable head, buried itself in the equipment, and created a loud but mercifully brief snarl of feedback. The other took him in the throat. He staggered forward one step, then two. Oi dropped to the floor and backed away from him, snarling. A third step took TikTok out into the throne room proper. He raised his arms toward Jake, and the boy could read Tiki's hatred in his remaining green eye. The boy thought he could hear the man's last hateful thought. "Oh, you fucking little squint!" Then TikTok collapsed forward, as he had collapsed in the cradle of the Greys. Only this time he would rise no more. "Thus fell Lord Perth, and the earth did shake with that thunder," said the man on the throne. "Except he's not a man," Jake thought. "Not a man at all. We've found the wizard at last, I think, and I'm pretty sure I know what's in the bag he has." "Martin," Roland said. He held out his left hand, the one which was still whole. "Martin Broadcloak. After all these years, after all these centuries."
"Want this, Roland?"
Eddie put the gun he had used to kill the TikTok man in Roland's hand. A tendril of blue smoke was still rising from the barrel. Roland looked at the old revolver as if he had never seen it before, then slowly lifted it and pointed it at the grinning, rosy-cheeked figure sitting cross-legged on the Green Palace's throne. "Finally," Roland breathed, thumbing back the trigger. "Finally in my sights." 8. That six-shooter will do you no good, as I think you know, the man on the throne said. Not against me. Only misfires against me, Roland, old fellow. How's the family, by the way? I seem to have lost touch with them over the years. I was always such a lousy correspondent. Someone ought to take a horsewhip to me, aye, so they should. He threw back his head and laughed. Roland pulled the trigger of the gun in his hand. When the hammer fell, there was only a dull click.
"Told you,"
the man on the throne said. "I think you must have gotten some of those wet slugs in there by accident, don't you? The ones with the flat powder? Good for blocking the sound of the thinny, but not so good for shooting old wizards, are they? Too bad. And your hand, Roland, look at your hand. Short a couple of fingers by the look. My, this has been hard on you, hasn't it? Things could get easier, though. You and your friends could have a fine, fruitful life. And, as Jake would say, that is the truth. No more lobstrosities, no more mad trains, no more disquieting, not to mention dangerous trips to other worlds. All you have to do is give over this stupid and hopeless quest for the tower."
"No,"
Eddie said. "No," Susanna said.
"No,"
Jake said. "No," Oi said, and added a bark. The dark man on the green throne continued to smile, unperturbed. "Roland," he asked, "what about you?" Slowly he raised the drawstring bag. It looked dusty and old. It hung from the wizard's fist like a teardrop, and now the thing in its pouch began to pulse with pink light. "Cry off, and they need never see what's inside this. They need never see the last scene of that sad, long-ago play. Cry off. Turn from the tower and go your way."
"No,"
Roland said. He began to smile, and as his smile broadened, that of the man sitting on the throne began to falter. "You can enchant my guns, those of this world, I reckon," he said. "Roland, I don't know what you're thinking of, laddie, but I warn you not to cross Oz the Great, Oz the Powerful, but I think I will, Martin, or Merlin, or whoever you call yourself now." "Flag, actually," the man on the throne said, "and we've met before." He smiled. Instead of broadening his face, as smiles usually did, it contracted Flag's features into a narrow and spiteful grimace. "In the wreck of Gilead. You and your surviving pals, that laughing donkey Cuthbert Allgood made one of your party, I remember, and Dick Curry, the fellow with the birthmark, made another, were on your way west to seek the tower. Or in the parlance of Jake's world, you were off to see the wizard. I know you saw me, but I doubt you knew until now that I saw you as well."
"And will again, I reckon," Roland said, "unless, that is, I kill you now and put an end to your interference."
Still holding his own gun out in his left hand, he went for the one tucked in the waistband of his jeans, Jake's Ruger, a gun from another world, and perhaps immune to this creature's enchantments, with his right. And he was fast as he had always been fast, his speed blinding. The man on the throne shrieked and cringed back. The bag fell from his lap, and the glass ball, once held by Rhea, once held by Jonas, once held by Roland himself, slipped out of its mouth. Smoke, green this time instead of red, billowed from the slots in the arms of the throne. It rose in obscuring fumes. Yet Roland still might have shot the figure disappearing into the smoke if he had made a clean draw. He didn't, however. The Ruger slid in the grip of his reduced hand, then twisted. The front sight caught on his belt buckle. It took only an extra quarter second for him to free the snag, but that was the quarter second he had needed. He pumped three shots into the billowing smoke, then ran forward, oblivious of the shouts of the others. He waved the smoke aside with his hands. His shots had shattered the back of the throne into thick green slabs of glass, but the man-shaped creature which had called itself Flag was gone. Roland found himself already beginning to wonder if he, or it, had been there in the first place. The ball was still there, however, unharmed and glowing the same enticing pink he remembered from so long ago, from Magus, when he had been young and in love.
This survivor of Merlin's rainbow had rolled almost to the edge of the throne's seat. 2 more inches and it would have plunged over and shattered on the floor. Yet it had not. Still, it remained, this bewitched thing Susan Delgado had first glimpsed through the window of Rhea's hut, under the light of the kissing moon. Roland picked it up, how well it fit his hand, how natural it felt against his palm, even after all these years, and looked into its cloudy, troubled depths. "You always did have a charmed life," he whispered to it. He thought of Rhea, as he had seen her in this ball, her ancient laughing eyes. He thought of the flames from the Reap Night bonfire rising around Susan, making her beauty shimmer in the heat, making it shiver like a mirage. "Wretched Glam," he thought. "If I dashed you to the floor, surely we would drown in the sea of tears that would pour out of your split belly, the tears of all those you've put to ruin. And why not do it? Left whole, the nasty thing might be able to help them back to the path of the beam, but Roland didn't believe they actually needed it. He thought that Tick-Tock and the creature which had called itself Flag had been their last challenge in that regard. The Green Palace was their door back to Midworld, and it was theirs now. They had conquered it by force of arms. "But you can't go yet, Gunslinger. Not until you've finished your story, told the last scene." Whose voice was that? Vanay's? No. Court's? No. Nor was it the voice of his father, who had once turned him naked out of a whore's bed. That was the hardest voice, the one he often heard in his troubled dreams, the one he wanted so to please and so seldom could. No, not that voice, not this time. This time what he heard was the voice of Ka. Ka like a wind. He had told so much of that awful 14th year, but he hadn't finished the tale. As with Detta Walker and the Blue Lady's 4 special plate, there was one more thing, a hidden thing. The question wasn't, he saw, whether or not the 5 of them could find their way out of the Green Palace and recover the path of the beam. The question was whether or not they could go on as Ka-Tet. If they were to do that, there could be nothing hidden. He would have to tell them of the final time he had looked into the wizard's glass in that long-ago year, 3 nights past the welcoming banquet it had been. He would have to tell them, "No, Roland," the voice whispered. "Not just tell. Not this time. You know better." Yes, he knew better. "Come," he said, turning to them. They drew slowly around him, their eyes wide and filling with the ball's flashing pink light. Already they were half-hypnotized by it, even Oi. "We are Ka-Tet," Roland said, holding the ball toward them. "We are one from many. I lost my one true love at the beginning of my quest for the Dark Tower. Now look into this wretched thing, if you would, and see what I lost not long after. See it once and for all. See it very well." They looked. The ball, cupped in Roland's upraised hands, began to pulse faster. It gathered them in and swept them away. Caught and whirled in the grip of that pink storm, they flew over the wizard's rainbow to the Gilead that had been. Chapter 4. The Glass. Jake of New York stands in an upper corridor of the Great Hall of Gilead, more castle here in the Greenland than Mayor's house. He looks around and sees Susanna and Eddie standing by a tapestry, their eyes big, their hands tightly entwined. And Susanna is standing. She has her legs back, at least for now. And what she called cappies have been replaced by a pair of ruby slippers exactly like those Dorothy wore when she stepped out upon her version of the Great Road to find the Wizard of Oz, that bumhug. She has her legs because this is a dream, Jake thinks. but knows it is no dream. He looks down and sees Oi looking up at him with his anxious, intelligent, gold-ringed eyes. He is still wearing the red booties. Jake bends and strokes Oi's head. The feel of the bumbler's fur under his hand is clear and real. No, this isn't a dream. Yet Roland is not here, he realizes. They are four instead of five. He realizes something else as well. The air of this corridor is faintly pink, and small pink halos revolve around the funny, old-fashioned light bulbs that illuminate the corridor. Something is going to happen. Some story is going to play out in front of their eyes. And now, as if the very thought had summoned them, the boy hears the click of approaching footfalls. It's a story I know, Jake thinks, one I've been told before. As Roland comes around the corner, he realizes what story it is. The one where Martin Broadcloak stops Roland as Roland passes by on his way to the rooftop where it will perhaps be cooler. You boy, Martin will say, come in, don't stand in the hall. Your mother wants to speak to you. But of course that isn't the truth, was never the truth, will never be the truth, no matter how much time slips and bends. What Martin wants is for the boy to see his mother and to understand that Gabrielle Duchesne has become the mistress of his father's wizard. Martin wants to goad the boy into an early test of manhood while his father is away and can't put a stop to it. He wants to get the puppy out of his way before it can grow teeth long enough to bite. Now they will see all this. The sad comedy will go its sad and preordained course in front of their eyes. I'm too young, Jake thinks. But of course he is not too young. Roland will be only 3 years older when he comes to Magus with his friends and meets Susan upon the great road. Only 3 years older when he loves her. Only 3 years older when he loses her. I don't care. I don't want to see it. And won't, he realizes as Roland draws closer. All that has already happened. For this is not August, the time of full earth, but late fall or early winter. He can tell by the serape Roland wears, a souvenir of his trip to the outer ark, and by the vapor that smokes from his mouth and nose each time he exhales. No central heating in Gilead, and it's cold up here. There are other changes as well. Roland is now wearing the guns which are his birthright, the big ones with the sandalwood grips. His father passed them on at the banquet, Jake thinks. He doesn't know how he knows this, but he does, and Roland's face, although still that of a boy, is not the open, untried face of the one who idled up this same corridor 5 months before. The boy who was ensnared by Martin has been through much since then, and his battle with Court has been the very least of it. Jake sees something else, too. The boy gunslinger is wearing the red cowboy boots. He doesn't know it, though, because this isn't really happening. Yet, somehow it is. They are inside the wizard's glass. They are inside the pink storm. Those pink halos revolving around the light fixtures remind Jake of the falls of the hounds and the moon bows revolving in the mist, and this is happening all over again. Roland! Eddie calls from where he and Susanna stand by the tapestry. Susanna gasps and squeezes his shoulder, wanting him to be silent, but Eddie ignores her. No, Roland, don't! Bad idea!
No, Olan!
Oi yaps. Roland ignores both of them, and he passes by Jake a hand's breadth away without seeing him. For Roland, they are not here. Red boots or no red boots, this quartet is far in his future. He stops at a door near the end of the corridor, hesitates, then raises his fist and knocks. Eddie starts down the corridor toward him, still holding Susanna's hand. Now he looks almost as if he is dragging her. Come on, Jake, says Eddie.
No, I don't want to.
It's not about what you want, and you know it. We're supposed to see. If we can't stop him, we can at least do what we came here to do. Now, come on! Heart heavy with dread, his stomach clenched in a knot, Jake comes along. As they approach Roland, the guns look enormous on his slim hips, and his unlined but already tired face somehow makes Jake feel like weeping. The gunslinger knocks again.
She ain't there, sugar!
Susanna shouts at him. She ain't there or she ain't answering the door, and which one it is don't matter to you. Leave it. Leave her. She ain't worth it. Just being your mother don't make her worth it. Go away. But he doesn't hear her either, and he doesn't go away. As Jake, Eddie, Susanna, and Oi gather unseen behind him, Roland tries the door to his mother's room and finds it unlocked. He opens it,
revealing a shadowy chamber decorated with silk hangings. On the floor is a rug that looks like the Persians beloved of Jake's mother, only this rug, Jake knows, comes from the province of Kashamin. On the far side of the parlor, by a window which has been shuttered against the winter winds, Jake sees a low-backed chair and knows it is the one she was in on the day of Roland's manhood test. It is where she was sitting when her son observed the love bite on her neck. The chair is empty now, but as the gunslinger takes another step into the room and turns to look toward the apartment's bedroom, Jake observes a pair of shoes, black, not red, beneath the drapes flanking the shuttered window.
"Roland!" he shouts. "Roland, behind the drapes! Someone behind the drapes! Look out!"
But Roland doesn't hear. "Mother?" he calls, and even his voice is the same. Jake would know it anywhere, but it is such a magically freshened version of it, young and uncracked by all the years of dust and wind and cigarette smoke. "Mother, it's Roland. I want to talk to you." Still no answer. He walks down the short hall which leads to the bedroom. Part of Jake wants to stay here in the parlor to go to that drape and yank it aside. But he knows this isn't the way it's supposed to go. Even if he tried, he doubts it would do any good. His hand would likely pass right through, like the hand of a ghost.
"Come on," Eddie says. "Stay with him."
They go, in a cluster that might have been comic under other circumstances, not under these. Here it is a case of three people desperate for the comfort of friends. Roland stands, looking at the bed against the room's left wall. He looks at it as if hypnotized. Perhaps he is trying to imagine Martin in it with his mother. Perhaps he is remembering Susan, with whom he never slept in a proper bed, let alone a canopied luxury such as this. Jake can see the gunslinger's dim profile in a three-paneled mirror across the room in an alcove. This triple glass stands in front of a small table the boy recognizes from his mother's side of his parents' bedroom. It is a vanity. The gunslinger shakes himself and comes back from whatever thoughts have seized his mind. On his feet are those terrible boots. In this dim light, they look like the boots of a man who has walked through a creek of blood.
"Mother!"
He takes a step toward the bed and actually bends a little, as if he thinks she might be hiding under it. If she's been hiding, however, it wasn't there. The shoes which Jake saw beneath the drape were women's shoes, and the shape which now stands at the end of the short corridor, just outside the bedroom door, is wearing a dress. Jake can see its hem. And he sees more than that. Jake understands Roland's troubled relationship with his mother and father better than Eddie or Susanna ever could, because Jake's own parents are peculiarly like them. Elmer Chambers is a gunslinger for the network, and Megan Chambers has a long history of sleeping with sick friends. This is nothing Jake has been told, but he knows somehow. He has shared Kef with his mother and father, and he knows what he knows. He knows something about Roland as well, that he saw his mother in the wizard's glass. It was Gabrielle Duchesne, fresh back from her retreat in Debaria, Gabrielle who would confess to her husband the errors of her ways and her thinking after the banquet, who would cry his pardon and beg to be taken back to his bed. And when Stephen drowsed after their lovemaking, she would bury the knife in his breast, or perhaps only lightly scratch his arm with it, not even waking him. With that knife, it would come to the same either way. Roland had seen it all in the glass before finally turning the wretched thing over to his father, and Roland had put a stop to it. To save Stephen Duchesne's life, Eddie and Susanna would have said, had they seen so far into the business, but Jake has the unhappy wisdom of unhappy children and sees further. To save his mother's life as well. To give her one last chance to recover her sanity, one last chance to stand at her husband's side and be true, one last chance to repent of Martin Broadcloak. Surely she will. Surely she must. Roland saw her face that day, how unhappy she was, and surely she must. Surely she cannot have chosen the magician, if he can only make her see. So, unaware that he has once more lapsed into the unwisdom of the very young, Roland cannot grasp that unhappiness and shame are often no match for desire, he has come here to speak to his mother, to beg her to come back to her husband before it's too late. He has saved her from herself once, he will tell her, but he cannot do it again. And if she still won't go,
Jake thinks, or tries to brave it out, pretend she doesn't know what he's talking about, he'll give her a choice. Leave Gilead with his help, now, tonight, or be clapped in chains tomorrow morning, a traitor so outrageous she will almost certainly be hung as Hax the cook was hung. Mother, he calls, still unaware of the shape standing in the shadows behind him. He takes one further step into the room, and now the shape moves. The shape raises its hands. There is something in its hands. Not a gun, Jake can tell that much, but it has a deadly look to it, a snaky look somehow.
Roland, watch out!
Susanna shrieks, and her voice is like a magical switch. There is something on the dressing table. The glass, of course. Gabrielle has stolen it. It's what she'll bring to her lover as a consolation prize for the murder her son prevented. And now it lights, as if in response to Susanna's voice. It sprays brilliant pink light up the triple mirror and casts its glow back into the room. In that light, in that triple glass, Roland finally sees the figure behind him.
Christ!
Eddie Dean shrieks, horrified.
Oh, Christ, Roland, that's not your mother! That's...
It's not even a woman. Not really. Not anymore. It is a kind of living corpse in a road-filthy black dress. There are only a few straggling tufts of hair left on her head, and there's a gaping hole where her nose used to be, but her eyes still blaze, and the snake she holds wriggling between her hands is very lively. Even in his own horror, Jake has time to wonder if she got it from under the same rock where she found the one Roland killed. It is Rhea who has been waiting for the gunslinger in his mother's apartment. It is the Coos, come not just to retrieve her glam, but to finish with the boy who has caused her so much trouble.
"Now, ye trollops, get!"
she cries shrilly, cackling.
"Now ye'll pay!"
But Roland has seen her. In the glass he has seen her, Rhea betrayed by the very ball she came to take back, and now he is whirling, his hands dropping to his new guns with all their deadly speed. He is 14, his reflexes are the sharpest and quickest they'll ever be, and he goes off like exploding gunpowder.
"No, Roland, don't!"
Susanna screams.
"It's a trick, it's a glam!"
Jake has just time to look from the mirror to the woman actually standing in the doorway, has just time to realize he, too, has been tricked. Perhaps Roland also understands the truth at the last split second, that the woman in the doorway really is his mother, after all, that the thing in her hands isn't a snake but a belt, something she has made for him, a peace offering, mayhap, that the glass has lied to him in the only way it can, by reflection. In any case, it's too late. The guns are out and thundering, their bright yellow flashes lighting the room. He pulls the trigger of each gun twice before he can stop, and the four slugs drive Gabrielle Duchesne back into the corridor with the hopeful can-we-make-peace smile still on her face. She dies that way, smiling. Roland stands where he is, the smoking guns in his hands, his face cramped in a grimace of surprise and horror, just beginning to get the truth of what he must carry with him the rest of his life. He has used the guns of his father to kill his mother. Now cackling laughter fills the room. Roland does not turn. He is frozen by the woman in the blue dress and black shoes who lies bleeding in the corridor of her apartment, the woman he came to save and has killed instead. She lies with the hand-woven belt draped across her bleeding stomach. Jake turns for him, and is not surprised to see a green-faced woman in a pointed black hat swimming inside the ball. It is the Wicked Witch of the East. It is also, he knows, Rhea of the Coos. She stares at the boy with the guns in his hands and bares her teeth at him in the most terrible grin Jake has ever seen in his life.
"I've burned the stupid girl you loved. I burned her alive, I did. And now I've made ye a matricide. Do you repent of killing my snake yet, gunslinger? My poor sweet Ermot. Do you regret playing your hard games with one more trig than ye'll ever be in your miserable life?"
He gives no sign that he hears, only stares at his lady mother.
Soon he will go to her, kneel by her. But not yet. Not yet. The face in the ball now turns toward the three pilgrims, and as it does, it changes, becomes old and bald and raddled, becomes in fact the face Roland saw in the lying mirror. The gunslinger has been unable to see his future friends, but Rhea sees them. Aye, she sees them very well.
"Cry it off," she croaks.
It is the caw of a raven sitting on a leafless branch beneath a winter-dimmed sky.
"Cry it off! Renounce the tower!"
"Never, you bitch," Eddie says.
"You see what he is, what a monster he is, and this is only the beginning of it, you can. Ask him what happened to Cuthbert, to Alain. Alain's touch, clever as 'twas, saved him not in the end, so it didn't. Ask him what happened to Jamie de Curry. He never had a friend he didn't kill, never had a lover who's not dust in the wind."
"Go your way," Susanna says, "and leave us to ours."
Rhea's green, cracked lips twist in a horrible sneer.
"He's killed his own mother. What will he do to you, you stupid brown-skinned bitch?"
"He didn't kill her," Jake said. "You killed her. Now go!"
Jake takes a step toward the ball, meaning to pick it up and dash it to the floor. And he can do that, he realizes, for the ball is real. It's the one thing in this vision that is. But before he can put his hands to it, it flashes a soundless explosion of pink light. Jake throws his hands up in front of his face to keep from being blinded, and then he is
melting. "I'm melting. What a world. Oh, what a world."
Falling. He is being whirled down through the pink storm, out of Oz and back to Kansas, out of Oz and back to Kansas, out of Oz and back to... Chapter 5. The Path of the Beam. 1.
"Home,"
Eddie muttered. His voice sounded thick and punch-drunk to his own ears.
"Back home. Because there's no place like home. No, indeed."
He tried to open his eyes, and at first couldn't. It was as if they were glued shut. He put the heel of his hand to his forehead and pushed up, tightening the skin on his face. It worked. His eyes popped open. He saw neither the throne room of the Green Palace nor, and this was what he had really expected, the richly appointed but somehow claustrophobic bedroom in which he had just been. He was outside, lying in a small clearing of winter-white grass. Nearby was a little grove of trees, some still with their last brown leaves clinging to the branches, and one branch with an odd white leaf, an albino leaf. There was a pretty trickle of running water farther into the grove. Standing abandoned in the high grass was Susanna's new and improved wheelchair. There was mud on the tires, Eddie saw, and a few late leaves, crispy and brown, caught in the spokes. A few swatches of grass, too. Overhead was a sky full of still white clouds, every bit as interesting as a laundry basket full of sheets. The sky was clear when we went inside the palace, he thought, and realized time had slipped again. How much or how little, he wasn't sure he wanted to know. Roland's world was like a transmission with its gear teeth all but stripped away. You never knew when time was going to pop into neutral or race you away in overdrive. Was this Roland's world, though? And if it was, how had they gotten back to it?
"How should I know?"
Eddie croaked, and got slowly to his feet, wincing as he did so. He didn't think he was hungover, but his legs were sore, and he felt as if he had just taken the world's heaviest Sunday afternoon nap. Roland and Susanna lay on the ground under the trees. The gunslinger was stirring, but Susanna lay on her back, arms spread extravagantly wide, snoring in an unladylike way that made Eddie grin. Jake was nearby, with Oi sleeping on his side by one of the kid's knees. As Eddie looked at them, Jake opened his eyes and sat up. His gaze was wide, but blank. He was awake, but had been so heavily asleep he didn't know it yet.
grass, Jake said, and yawned.
Yep, Eddie said, that works for me.
He turned in a slow circle, and had gotten three-quarters of the way back to where he'd started when he saw the green palace on the horizon. From here it looked very small, and its brilliance had been robbed by the sunless day. Eddie guessed it might be 30 miles away. Leading toward them from that direction were the tracks of Susanna's wheelchair. He could hear the thinny, but faintly. He thought he could see it as well, a quicksilver shimmer like bog water stretching across the flat, open land and finally drying up about 5 miles away. 5 miles west of here? Given the location of the Green Palace and the fact that they had been traveling east on I-70, that was the natural assumption. But who really knew, especially with no visible sun to use for orientation?
"Where's the turnpike?"
Jake asked. His voice sounded thick and gummy. Oi joined him, stretching first one rear leg, then the other. Eddie saw he had lost one of his booties at some point.
"Maybe it was canceled due to lack of interest."
"I don't think we're in Kansas anymore," Jake said. Eddie looked at him sharply, but didn't believe the kid was consciously riffing on the Wizard of Oz.
"Not the one where the Kansas City Royals play. Not the one where the Monarchs play, either."
"What gives you that idea?"
Jake hoisted a thumb toward the sky, and when Eddie looked up, he saw that he had been wrong. It wasn't all still white overcast, boring as a basket of sheets. Directly above their heads, a band of clouds was moiling toward the horizon, as steadily as a conveyor belt. They were back on the path of the beam. 2.
"Eddie? Where you at, sugar?"
Eddie looked down from the lane of clouds in the sky and saw Susanna sitting up, rubbing the back of her neck. She looked unsure of where she was, perhaps even of who she was. The red cappy she was wearing looked oddly dull in this light, but they were still the brightest things in Eddie's view. Until he looked down at his own feet and saw the street boppers with their Cuban heels. Yet these also looked dull, and Eddie no longer thought it was just the day's cloudy light that made them seem so. He looked at Jake's shoes, Oi's remaining three slippers, Roland's cowboy boots. The gunslinger was sitting up now, arms crossed around his knees, looking blankly off into the distance. All the same ruby red, but a lifeless red somehow, as if some magic essential to them had been used up. Suddenly Eddie wanted them off his feet. He sat down beside Susanna, gave her a kiss, and said, "Good morning, sleeping beauty. Or afternoon, if it's that." Then, quickly, almost hating to touch them, it was like touching dead skin somehow, Eddie yanked off the street boppers. As he did, he saw that they were scuffed at the toes and muddy at the heels, no longer new-looking. He'd wondered how they'd gotten here. Now, feeling the ache in the muscles of his legs and remembering the wheelchair tracks, he knew. They had walked, by God, walked in their sleep. "That," Susanna said, "is the best idea you've had since, well, in a long time." She stripped off the cappies. Close by, Eddie saw Jake taking off Oi's booties.
"Were we there?" Susanna asked him. "Eddie, were we really there when he..."
"When I killed my mother," Roland said. "Yes, you were there. As I was, God's help me. I was there. I did it." He covered his face with his hands and began to voice a series of harsh sobs. Susanna crawled across to him in that agile way that was almost a version of walking. She put an arm around him and used her other hand to take his hands away from his face. At first, Roland didn't want to let her do that, but she was persistent. And at last his hands, those killer's hands, came down, revealing haunted eyes which swam with tears. Susanna urged his face down against her shoulder.
"Be easy, Roland," she said. "Be easy and let it go. This part is over now. You passed it."
"A man doesn't get past such a thing," Roland said. "No, I don't think so. Not ever."
"You didn't kill her,"
Eddie said. "That's too easy."
The gunslinger's face was still against Susanna's shoulder, but his words were clear enough.
Some responsibilities can't be shirked. Some sins can't be shirked. Yes, Rhea was there, in a way, at least. But I can't shift it all to the coups, much as I might like to.
It wasn't her either, Eddie said. That's not what I mean.
Roland raised his head. What in hell's name are you talking about?
Ka, Eddie said. Ka like a wind.
3. In their packs there was food none of them had put there. Cookies with Keebler elves on the packages, saran-wrapped sandwiches that looked like the kind you could get if you were desperate, that was, from turnpike vending machines, and a brand of cola neither Eddie, Susanna, nor Jake knew. It tasted like Coke and came in a red and white can, but the brand was Nazela. They ate a meal with their backs to the grove and their faces to the distant glam gleam of the green palace and called it lunch. If we start to lose a light in an hour or so, we can make it supper by voice vote, Eddie thought, but he didn't believe they'd need to. His interior clock was running again now, and that mysterious but usually accurate device suggested that it was early afternoon. At one point, he stood up and raised his soda, smiling into an invisible camera. "When I'm traveling through the land of Oz in my new Tokoro spirit, I drink Nazela," he proclaimed. "It fills me up, but never fills me out. It makes me happy to be a man. It makes me know God. It gives me the outlook of an angel and the balls of a tiger. When I drink Nazela, I say, 'Gosh, ain't I glad to be alive.' I say, 'Sit down, you bumhug,'" Jake said, laughing.
"Ugh," Oi agreed.
His snout was on Jake's ankle, and he was watching the boy's sandwich with great interest. Eddie started to sit, and then that strange albino leaf caught his eye again. "That's no leaf," he thought, and walked over to it. No, not a leaf, but a scrap of paper. He turned it over and saw columns of blah blah and yak yak and all the stuff's the same. Usually newspapers weren't blank on one side, but Eddie wasn't surprised to find this one was. The Oz Daily Buzz had only been a prop, after all. Nor was the blank side blank. Printed on it in neat, careful letters was this message: "Next time I won't leave. Renounce the tower. This is your last warning. And have a great day. R.F." Below that, a little drawing. Eddie brought the note back to where the others were eating. Each of them looked at it. Roland held it last, ran his thumb over it thoughtfully, feeling the texture of the paper, then gave it back to Eddie.
"R.F.," Eddie said. "The man who was running TikTok, this is from him, isn't it?"
"Yes. He must have brought the TikTok man out of Ludd."
"Sure," Jake said darkly.
"That guy Flag looked like someone who'd know a first-class bumhug when he found one. But how did they get here before us? What could be faster than Blaine the Mono, for cripe's sake?"
"A door," Eddie said. "Maybe they came through one of those special doors."
"Bingo," Susanna said. She held her hand out, palm up, and Eddie slapped it.
"In any case, what he suggests is not bad advice," Roland said. "I urge you to consider it most seriously, and if you want to go back to your world, I will allow you to go."
"Roland, I can't believe you," Eddie said. "This after you dragged me and Suze over here kicking and screaming? You know what my brother would say about you, that you're as contrary as a hog on ice skates."
"I did what I did before I learned to know you as friends," Roland said. "Before I learned to love you as I loved Elaine and Cuthbert, and before I was forced to revisit certain scenes. Doing that as..." He paused, looking down at his feet. He had put his old boots back on again, and thinking hard. At last he looked up again. "There was a part of me that hadn't moved or spoken in a good many years. I thought it was dead. It isn't. I have learned to love again. And I'm aware that this is probably my last chance to love. I'm slow, Vanay and Court knew that, so did my father. But I'm not stupid."
"Then don't act that way," Eddie said, "or treat us as if we were."
"What you call the bottom line, Eddie, is this. I get my friends killed. And I'm not sure I can even risk doing that again.
Jake especially. I... never mind. I don't have the words. For the first time since I turned around in a dark room and killed my mother, I may have found something more important than the tower. Leave it at that.
All right, I guess I can respect that. So can I, Susanna said, but Eddie's right about Carr.
She took the note and ran a finger over it thoughtfully.
Roland, you can't talk about that, Carr, I mean, then turn around and take it back again, just because you get a little low on willpower and dedication.
Willpower and dedication are good words, Roland remarked. There's a bad one, though, that means the same thing. That one is obsession. She shrugged it away with an impatient twitch of her shoulders.
Sugar Pie, either this whole business is Carr or none of it is. And scary as Carr might be, the idea of fate with eagle eyes and a bloodhound's nose, I find the idea of no Carr even scarier.
She tossed the RF note aside on the matted grass. Whatever you call it, you're just as dead if it runs you over, Roland said. Reimer, Thorin, Jonas, my mother, Cuthbert, Susan, just ask them, any of them, if you only could.
You're missing the biggest part of this, Eddie said. You can't send us back. Don't you realize that, you big galoot? Even if there was a door, we wouldn't go through it. Am I wrong about that?
He looked at Jake and Susanna. They shook their heads. Even Oi shook his head. No, he wasn't wrong.
We've changed, Eddie said. We...
Now, he was the one who didn't know how to go on, how to express his need to see the tower, and his other need, just as strong, to go on carrying the gun with the sandalwood insets. The big iron was how he'd come to think of it, like in that old Marty Robbins song about the man with the big iron on his hip.
It's Carr, he said.
It was all he could think of that was big enough to cover it. Carr, Carr, Roland replied after a moment's consideration. The three of them stared at him, mouths open. Roland of Gilead had made a joke.
4. There's one thing I don't understand about what we saw, Susanna said hesitantly. Why did your mother hide behind that drape when you came in, Roland? Did she mean to...
She bit her lip, then brought it out.
Did she mean to kill you?
If she'd meant to kill me, she wouldn't have chosen a belt as her weapon. The very fact that she had made me a present, and that's what it was, it had my initials woven into it, suggests that she meant to ask my forgiveness, that she had had a change of heart. Is that what you know, or only what you want to believe, Eddie thought. It was a question he would never ask. Roland had been tested enough, had won their way back to the path of the beam by reliving that terrible final visit to his mother's apartment, and that was enough.
I think she hid because she was ashamed, the gunslinger said. Or because she needed a moment to think of what to say to me, of how to explain.
And the ball? Susanna asked him gently. Was it on the vanity table where we saw it? And did she steal it from your father?
Yes to both, Roland said. Although, did she steal it? He seemed to ask this question of himself. My father knew a great many things, but he sometimes kept what he knew to himself.
Like him knowing that your mother and Martin were seeing each other, Susanna said.
Yes.
But, Roland, you surely don't believe that your father would knowingly have allowed you to...
Roland looked at her with large, haunted eyes. His tears had gone, but when he tried to smile at her question, he was unable. Have knowingly allowed his son to kill his wife? He asked. No, I can't say that. Much as I'd like to, I can't. That he should have caused such a thing to have happened, to have deliberately set it in motion like a man playing castles, that I cannot believe. But would he allow Carr to run its course? Aye, most certainly.
What happened to the ball? Jake asked.
I don't know. I fainted. When I awoke, my mother and I were still alone, one dead and one alive. No one had come to the sound of the shots. The walls of that place were thick stone, and that wing mostly empty as well. Her blood had dried. The belt she'd made me was covered with it, but I took it and I put it on. I wore that blood-stained gift for many years, and how I lost it is a tale for another day. I'll tell it to you before we have done, for it bears on my quest for the tower. But although no one had come to investigate the gunshots, someone had come for another reason. While I lay fainted away by my mother's corpse, that someone came in and took the wizard's glass away. "Rhea?" Eddie asked. I doubt she was so close in her body, but she had a way of making friends, that one. Aye, a way of making friends. I saw her again, you know. Roland explained no further, but a stony gleam arose in his eyes. Eddie had seen it before and knew it meant killing. Jake had retrieved the note from R.F. and now gestured at the little drawing beneath the message.
"Do you know what this means?"
"I have an idea it's the sigil of a place I saw when I first traveled in the wizard's glass. The land called Thunderclap." He looked around at them one by one. "I think it's there that we'll meet this man, this thing named Flag, again." Roland looked back the way they had come, sleepwalking in their fine red shoes. The Kansas we came through was his Kansas, and the plague that emptied out that land was his plague. At least that's what I believe.
"But it might not stay there," Susanna said.
"It could travel," Eddie said.
"To our world," Jake said.
Still looking back toward the green palace, Roland said, "To your world or any other."
"Who's the Crimson King?" Susanna asked abruptly.
"Susanna, I know not." They were quiet then, watching Roland look toward the palace where he had faced a false wizard and a true memory, and somehow opened the door back to his own world by so doing.
"Our world," Eddie thought, slipping an arm around Susanna. "Our world now. If we go back to America, and perhaps we'll have to before this is over, we'll arrive as strangers in a strange land, no matter what when it is. This is our world now, the world of the beams and the guardians and the dark tower."
"We got some daylight left," he said to Roland, and put a hesitant hand on the gunslinger's shoulder. When Roland immediately covered it with his own hand, Eddie smiled.
"You want to use it or what?"
"Yes," Roland said, "let's use it." He bent and shouldered his pack.
"What about the shoes?" Susanna asked, looking doubtfully at the little red pile they had made.
"Leave them here," Eddie said. "They've served their purpose. Into your wheelchair, girl." He put his arms around her and helped her in. "All God's children have shoes," Roland mused. "Isn't that what you said, Susanna?"
"Well," she said, settling herself, "the correct dialect adds a soupçon of flavor, but you got the essence, honey, yes."
"Then we'll undoubtedly find more shoes as God wills it," Roland said. Jake was looking into his knapsack, taking inventory of the foodstuffs that had been added by some unknown hand. He held up a chicken leg in a baggie, looked at it, then looked at Eddie.
"Who do you suppose packed this stuff?"
Eddie raised his eyebrows, as if to ask Jake how he could possibly be so stupid.
"The Keebler elves," he said. "Who else? Come on, let's go."
5. They clustered near the grove, 5 wanderers on the face of an empty land. Ahead of them, running across the plain, was a line in the grass which exactly matched the lane of rushing clouds in the sky. This line was nothing so obvious as a path, but to the awakened eye, the way that everything bent in the same direction was as clear as a painted stripe. The path of the beam. Somewhere ahead, where this beam intersected all the others, stood the dark tower. Eddie thought that if the wind were right, he would almost be able to smell its sullen stone. And roses. The dusky scent of roses. He took Susanna's hand as she sat in her chair. Susanna took Roland's, Roland took Jake's. Oi stood 2 paces before them, head up, scenting the autumn air that combed his fur with unseen fingers, his gold-ringed eyes wide.
"We are Ka-Tet," Eddie said. It crossed his mind to wonder at how much he'd changed, how he had become a stranger even to himself.
"We are one from many." "Ka-Tet," Susanna said. "We are one from many."
"One from many," Jake said.
"Come on, let's go." Bird and bear and hare and fish, Eddie thought. With Oi in the lead, they once more set out for the Dark Tower, walking along the path of the beam.
Afterward. The scene in which Roland bests his old teacher Court and goes off to Royster in the less savory section of Gilead was written in the spring of 1970. The one in which Roland's father shows up the following morning was written in the summer of 1996. Although only 16 hours passed between the two occurrences in the world of the story, 26 years had passed in the life of the story's teller. Yet the moment finally came, and I found myself confronting myself across a whore's bed. The unemployed schoolboy with the long black hair and beard on one side, the successful popular novelist America's Schlockmeister, as I am affectionately known by my legions of admiring critics, on the other. I mention this only because it sums up the essential weirdness of the Dark Tower experience for me. I have written enough novels and short stories to fill a solar system of the imagination, but Roland's story is my Jupiter, a planet that dwarfs all the others, at least from my own perspective, a place of strange atmosphere, crazy landscape, and savage gravitational pull. Dwarfs the others, did I say? I think there's more to it than that, actually. I am coming to understand that Roland's world, or worlds, actually contains all the others of my making. There was a place in Midworld for Randall Flagg, Ralph Roberts, the wandering boys from the Eyes of the Dragon, even Father Callahan, the damned priest from Salem's Lot, who rode out of New England on a Greyhound bus and wound up dwelling on the border of a terrible Midworld land called Thunderclap. This seems to be where they all finish up. And why not? Midworld was here first, before all of them, dreaming under the blue gaze of Roland's bombardier eyes. This book has been too long in coming. A good many readers who enjoy Roland's adventures have all but howled in frustration, and for that I apologize. The reason is best summed up by Susanna's thought as she prepares to tell Blaine the first riddle of their contest. It is hard to begin. There's nothing in these pages that I agree with more. I knew that Wizard and Glass meant doubling back to Roland's young days and to his first love affair, and I was scared to death of that story. Suspense is relatively easy, at least for me. Love is hard. Consequently, I dallied, I temporized, I procrastinated, and the book remained unwritten. I began, at last, working in motel rooms on my Macintosh PowerBook, while driving cross-country from Colorado to Maine after finishing my work on the miniseries version of The Shining. It occurred to me as I drove north through the deserted miles of western Nebraska, where I also happened to be driving back from Colorado when I got the idea for a story called Children of the Corn, that if I didn't start soon, I would never write the book at all. But I no longer know the truth of romantic love, I told myself. I know about marriage and mature love, but 48 has a way of forgetting the heat and passion of 17. I will help you with that part, came the reply. I didn't know who that voice belonged to on that day outside Thetford, Nebraska, but I do now, because I have looked into his eyes across a whore's bed in a land that exists very clearly in my imagination. Roland's love for Susan Delgado and hers for him is what was told to me by the boy who began this story. If it's right, thank him. If it's wrong, blame whatever got lost in the translation. Also thank my friend Chuck Verrill, who edited the book and hung with me every step of the way. His encouragement and help was invaluable, as was the encouragement of Elaine Koster, who has published all of these cowboy romances in paperback. Most thanks of all go to my wife, who supports me in this madness as best she can, and helped me on this book in a way she doesn't even know.
Once, in a dark time, she gave me a funny little rubber figure that made me smile. It's Rocket J. Squirrel, wearing his blue aviator's hat and with his arms bravely outstretched. I put that figure on my manuscript as it grew and grew and grew, hoping some of the love that came with it would kind of fertilize the work. It must have worked, at least to a degree. The book is here, after all. I don't know if it's good or bad. I lost all sense of perspective around page 400, but it's here. That alone seems like a miracle. And I have started to believe I might actually live to complete this cycle of stories, knock on wood. There are three more to be told, I think. Two set chiefly in Midworld and one almost entirely in our world. That's the one dealing with the vacant lot on the corner of 2nd and 46th, and the rose that grows there. That rose, I must tell you, is in terrible danger. In the end, Roland's quartet will come to the nightscape which is Thunderclap, and to what lies beyond it. All may not live to reach the tower, but I believe that those who do reach it will stand and be true. Stephen King, Lovell, Maine, October 27, 1996.
This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.